is my request. You don't have to play it, but I hope you'll do your best. I've been listening to your show on the radio, and you seem like a friend to me.
Party to hop on for 8 o'clock at the Greater 3UZ Sammy Show for Friday night.
Okay, the time is 22 before 9, 1272 SM with Ian McRae in the morning.
4AP and Kevin Hillier, Sunday morning, out for a couple of showers later today and a top of 25.
Well, it's 27 past 12 right now. This is Laurie Bennett at 2SM.
At 24 to 8 with Peter Grayson, town at the moment 17 degrees.
Howdy, hi, Victoria. Stan the man. Hello.
Well, hi and welcome once again to Pilots of the Airwaves. It is our 40 minutes or so where we get to speak to the people behind the voices who are friends to a whole generation. And today's guest worked all along the east coast of Australia from Cairns right down to Melbourne and some pretty interesting places in between. And just when some might be looking to wander into the sunset, he and his siblings decide it might be a good time to create their own radio station. Some may know him as Hans Christian, however to most of us, it's Hans Torv. Hey Hans, welcome to Pilots, and thanks for joining us.
Paul, well, my pleasure, and I just want to say thank you and congratulations on Pilots of the Airwaves. It's a project that's clearly warm in your heart, and it's given a lot of us pleasure to relive some of the reminiscences.
Well, thank you for that. Now, speaking of reminiscing, obviously radio played a major part in the life of the Torv family in the adult years. But how important and accessible was radio when you guys were all growing up?
Yeah, it's interesting. We never had a television at home, and I have my earliest recollections is the radio in the corner of the lounge room, and with the old big stand-up, transistor set. And I remember we used to be able to change the transistors in the damn thing, so we'd pull it out when it broke. But and on weekends, I remember Saturdays, even though my father wasn't a racing fan, the sound of the Saturday races being called was just part of that Saturday afternoon in Sydney's West, and it was there. And then it slowly changed when we got a television. But I do recall winning prizes from 2UE when I was 7 or 8, I suppose. And I remember particularly what the prize was, and I think it was Gary O'Callaghan was doing the show. It was an inflatable knockdown Donald Duck. So it had sand in the bottom. Anyway, but so I'm clearly a prize pig from the very early days.
Now, so many of our guests run out of the school gate as quickly as they can, head to a radio school, and then off to their first country appointment. Your story is slightly different, as you must have done pretty well at school to at least start a law degree at the University of New South Wales.
Yeah, I did. My brother was already in media. He was working on 2SM. He had returned to Sydney by that stage. But it didn't strike me as something I really wanted to do. So, and I was the first of my family to go to university. I won a scholarship, and my father was proud of it, so I couldn't say I'm not going. But I cracked it for a year, and then after 1 year I thought I'll give this a break for a bit because I was just a bit bored with it. I wasn't bad at school, I did okay. So then I just got a job at George Patterson's Advertising, and I thought I'll just do this for a year and then have a bit of a Yahoo with my mates and things like that. And then what happened next was my brother's working up the road. I'm in George Patterson's as a dispatch clerk. He's having more fun than I am. So I thought, well, maybe I'll have a crack at that for another year and then I'll go back to university. So here we are, 53 years later, still no university.
No doubt it was an interesting time at George Patterson with the likes of Craig Willis, Les Gock and earlier Pete Rudder all working there.
He was, and Les had Hush going in those days, and then he would be out doing gigs, and then there was always a competition about who had the coolest clothes. I think Les won that one. But then, and here's a rock band, Hush, and Les Gock, and they're putting out, you know, Christmas carols. I said, what are you doing, Les? Anyway, and then I spoke to Les many years later, and he was the first of us to have a Ferrari. Not that I have a Ferrari. I don't drive Ferrari. But anyway, it was a very interesting period. But we couldn't wait to escape Dispatch and George Patterson. So there are many, many stories about advertising agencies and where the money went. Certainly not to the Dispatch crew.
Now, did that brotherly connection prove to be helpful when getting that very first gig at 2WM in Mwillimbah?
It was, because I was speaking with my brother one day. I said, oh, you know, I might have want to go having a crack at that. He said, you need an audition tape. So, and I could have done it at George Patterson's because they had a production studio there. We had a full production facility in the old Bulletin building on George Street. And then he said, just come up here at 2SM and I'll get something set up for you there. So I roll into 2SM and my audition tape, I don't have a copy of it. I wish I'd kept it. But anyway, it was done by Rocky Rod Thomas, who was a legendary producer of the day. And it was a cracker of the tape. And I remember we're going through the music and I didn't know, but I don't think we should have put Cindy incidentally on it because it was pretty wild rock and tape. And we're sending this thing to all the regionals. So I sent the audition tape to every radio station that was near a beach in either New South Wales or Queensland. I didn't look at Victoria in those days. And then finally 2MW took the bait and I copped the job there and got my car and drove to Mwillimbah.
So what were some of the highlights and the lowlights of that very first appointment?
It's the only radio station I've been sacked from. So I lasted, I think, just under 12 months, 10 or 11 months. I'm a kid out of university, Sydney's eastern suburbs, you know, rowdy and doing whatever we wanted to. Come out of the biggest advertising agency in the nation at the time. And the general manager of the radio station is former naval commander who's wearing long socks, shoes, short sleeve shirt with a tie. His idea of radio and my idea of radio are two different things. We just didn't see eye to eye on very much, and it was a bit of a personality clash. And they pinged me as well for phoning my girlfriend on the company phones. They tapped the phone lines and said, who's calling their girlfriends at nighttime? And so, man, me. So anyway, out I went, and it cost me $8 in phone calls or something like that. But anyway, so that was there. But I did, my first program manager was there, and a guy called Stu McGuinness, and I've never forgotten him. He was a really nice bloke, very calm, very gentle, and he ended up in far north Queensland and the ABC. He was well known in the ABC, no longer with us, but he was just one of those guys who made it easy for me and gave it a good opportunity. Mind you, the gear in that joint was just atrocious. And I recall the studio, and it was, if you think about a 1950s, early 60s laminated kitchen table with an aluminium trim around the side of it, that was the studio desk with the gear bolted to it. It was just a rattle and move and hunt around the place. But it was an interesting time, you know. So, but everything was brand new, so it was all a good experience. So great tech, the technician, he's a place where the chief tech would come in and say, hey, you guys are not doing enough research and rehearsal and preparation for your shows. I'm going, this is the tech telling me this, and that stuck with me all this time to say, you know, do the prep, and he could recognise it. So it was pretty important stuff to do.
4CA in Cairns was the next stop. What was the 4CA format in the mid-70s, and what did they have you doing?
I got when I went to Cairns, I forget which shift I first started on. What happened was after I left NW, I went back to Sydney and worked as a brickies labourer. I had some mates in the building industry. So, you know, I spent another, I suppose, 8 or 9 months doing that. And then and I got the job in Cairns by going to the AWA office in York Street. They did all the employing, and then they handed me a T-shirt, a couple of 4CA T-shirts, and a ticket and said, go to Cairns. So I fly into Cairns, and I forget which shift I started on. I ended up doing breakfast. I often think of it as the wild, wild north, because everything went, and it wasn't a 24-hour station. We used to shut it down at night time. until, and then halfway through that period I was there, it became 24 hours. And then you'd get up there. But I remember the first weekend I was in town, and I went in on the Saturday morning just to familiarise myself with the building and, you know, what was going on and some of the gear in the studios. And it was only – the pub was – they put me up in the hotel on the corner and the studios were only two doors up. So I go in there. As I walk in, I got a key, so I open up, go in. There's only one person in there in the studio, and he's one of the sales people. Name not to be mentioned. I suppose he's not around anymore either. But every phone in the building was ringing, and I'm going, this is really weird. And anyway, so I answered one of the phones, you know, hello, 4CA. And the guy on the end of the phone says, oh, $20, horse free, race seven. So I go to the studio, and I say, hey, mate, there's a guy on line four trying to get on. He said, don't answer the phones. So he's running SP out of the radio station and would do settle up in the local pub on the following Monday. It was just, and got away with it for years and years until a new program director arrived not that long afterwards and confronted him and said to the boss, you can't do this, this is not right. So anyway, that was the Wild Wild North. But the format was just adult contemporary, you know, what went. Bob Burgess was there. I think Bob's still in town. He was doing a morning show. And he ended up buying a furniture business and things like that. And who else was there? Col Mooney turned up, who's well-known in Queensland radio. It's good people. Ray Furlong was the manager. He and his wife. His wife was more upset when I left, not for any other reason other than she said, you're putting pressure on Ray when I handed my resignation in. So it was kind of a family event. But the funny part about working up there in those days was he couldn't write a check. Everything had to come out of Sydney. All the wages, any expenses, all of that sort of thing had to come up from on the aircraft. If the aircraft didn't make it, nobody got paid. So it was a different world. Fantastic
for BC. That first Capital City gig was at Funtastic 4BC in Brisbane with the likes of Micah Hearn, Hayden Sargent, Graham Smith, Gary Suprain, Bruce McCartney, and the list goes on. Now, it was a very strong on-air lineup, so was it as much fun as the name suggests?
It was. It was good fun radio station, and it wasn't the youth station. Directly across the corner from 4BC was 4IP. They faced each other. And it was a massive operation, that 4BC. But Smitty picked me up at the airport when I went down for the interview to get the job. I was on my way to Sydney for a mate's wedding, and he said, "Stop off on the way through, and then come and have a chat." So I did. And he picked me up in a car it's a little Ford Escort painted Funtastic 4BC. It was like a circus on wheels, and there's a flat tire in the back seat and stuff. And then Smitty took me into to see Bob Stevenson, who's the GM at the time. And he said, listen, he said, when Bob meets you, he's going to ask you, do you like girls? And I said, what? He said, yeah, it's just something Bob's got. Anyway, so sure enough, somebody said, look, you got the gig. We'll go and see Bob. And we walk in. Hello, how are you going? Very nice. He had a massive office. It was good. He said, oh, that's all good. Somebody likes it. It's good. He said, listen, do you like girls? I said, yeah. He said, cool. So he said, Smitty, he's all right. So I don't know the connotations today, that's just happened. And Smitty knew exactly what he was going to do, and then off it went. So cop that gig. It was a good, fun place to work. And then 4IP across the road, Smitty used to, he's the program director. He had been at 4IP, and they had a full-size, life-size cutout of Smitty on the first floor facing the 4BC offices as well. So there's a fair bit on. McGurven was across the road in those days, and he was the king of town. He was a very, very funny operator. I had a really, really good time there. It was a lot of fun. As you say, there was a good, solid lineup of people and it was just professionals all the way through.
Now, is this the first time that Hans Christian graced the airwaves, and whose idea was the name change?
It was mine. I know, and I used Hans Christian at Cairns as well, because my brother was still in the game and very, very well known. I just thought I don't want to be trading on the family reputation. In hindsight, I probably would have changed it. I would have changed my first name, but I kept Hans. I don't know whether I did the right thing or the wrong thing or whatever, but I survived. I got paid as Hans Torb, so it was fine. as long as the money hit the bank account, nobody really worried too much about it. But it worked for what it was at the time, and then eventually it was a case of, well, just let's get serious about this now. And when I went to Torv, I maybe would have thought about changing my Christian name rather than using my something different, rather whatever. But anyway, it is what it is, and it stuck on the airwaves till I went to Newcastle as well.
Now, we're talking mid-70s in Brisbane. There was a reasonable amount of competition in the city at the time, with a number of stations seemingly aiming at relatively the same market. What was the 4BC point of difference?
We're more magazine kind of radio station, and also slightly less rocky. There was a lot of top 40, and the whole concept of the Fantastic, I think that was Steve-O's concept, whether he brought it from the US, I'm not sure. But the idea was a fun radio station with plenty of things happening and lots of interviews. So night times we threw the switch to Vaudeville and went chasing the kids. But during the day it was Hayden Sargent talkback, and then the afternoons and Peter Dick was there doing his thing as well. And you know, the next thing, you know, Pete's big thing was Silly Dick. That's what we call him. So we said, and it was pretty funny, silly stuff. And then Pete stayed in Brisbane a long time. I think he's on the sunny coast now, but he ended up working ABC and doing things like that. And, you know, good longevity for somebody who wanted to stay in the game up there. There were other guys. The funny part about there was, and there's a guy, a great production operator, Phil Lentz, and Phil did some terrific work out of that production studio. People don't realise how big BC was. It was on two floors. It had staff that I'd never met. And they had control operators, like not just techs. These guys would punch in because we did the racing, and we'd feed the racing from Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane and feed it up to the country. And these guys were in there plugging, you know, the stations into Longreach and stuff like that, so Longreach could pick up the feed. And I walked into Tex one day and said, "Who's this bloke here?" And he said, "That's George," or whatever his name was. I said, "I've been here for 7 months. I've never met him." And they said, "Oh, George lives out at the transmitter." And I said, "What?" They said, "There's a house at the transmitter. George lives there to service the transmitter and mow the lawn and keep the snakes away." There you go. Imagine that in a radio station today.
Now, the next move was away from a capital city station to 2NX in Newcastle, a station known as one of the great breeding grounds of on-air talent. How did that move come about?
Gary Suprain was at BC, and we're good mates and still are. Suprain was at BC, and then he went to, I'm just trying to work the timing, whether Smithy left first or Gary left first. So Suprain went to Newcastle with Gary Roberts. So pretty famous in the game, and hello Gary. So Gary Roberts was programming Newcastle. A job came up there. Suprain put my name up and said, "Can I talk to Torvy?" So Gary Roberts said, "Send me a tape," which I did, because I wanted to get into daytime. I was still doing nights at BC. I wanted to get into daytime, so sent the tape. He said, "Yeah, come on down." So down to Newcastle I went. So Suprain was there. Mike Webb was doing mornings. Dave Jones was doing breakfast, I think, at the time. Andy was doing afternoons, I think. Anyway, so the juggle came up. And then next, you know, Timmy Webster's there as well. So there was a good patch of people. But Gary Roberts knew what he wanted out of that radio station, and was another great program director who was, you know, really easy to work for, and clear direction. So you knew what you're going to get, and really, really balanced management. You know, not too many ups and downs. You knew it was very stable.
So, how much of your time working with Gary Roberts and the 2NX way of broadcasting shape your next 40 years in the business?
Well, it's funny because it's how to put this. There are a lot of great people in the radio game, and there are many better broadcasters than me and other people as well. And I often think that it's about being in the right place at the right time and the people who you touch base with on the way through. So I'm at 2NX because of Suprain, because we'd done that one. Gary Roberts is there. Gary goes to Perth. Gary Roberts leaves to an X with a promotion that says win a CD every week for the rest of your life, and then moves. Get a load of that one. Anyway, so Gary goes his way, and then I've been working with Smithy. Smithy goes to Melbourne, and that's how I end up going to Melbourne. But Soprane jumps to Melbourne too, and it's just a case of glancing through and meeting with other people. And that's, as I say, when it comes to right place, right time, it's about who you meet on the way. And it's not, I don't think it's a case of who you know. It's just about who says, oh, this guy's okay for that gig. Just have a think or have a look. And some of those jobs weren't advertised. They were just somebody makes the phone call. And Americans always say, oh, a program director drove through town. In Australia, it's not quite that big, but it was pretty good. But then, you know, but you listen to 2SM up the line all the time because that's, you know, it was the mother radio station. And Garvin Rutherford was the general manager. He'd gone. Then John McGann was the GM at 2NX, and another really great bloke who could run a radio station and make the station fun. It was, I remember walking in the first time, and he had a Friday afternoon drinks in the boardroom. And the first week I'm there, I go in and I've come out of Queensland, so I'm looking for Bundaberg Rum. And he's only got Jim Beam on the wall. And I said, he said, what's the matter? I said, there's no Bundy here. The next week I walk in, there's six bottles of Bundy lined up. So I fell in love with John. End up selling him some nice breed dogs, and I sold him a couple of dogs. So we're good mates for a long, long time.
Now, a natural progression for jocks from 2NX seemed to be an appointment at one of the more music format stations, which meant either 4IP, 2SM or 3XY. Where did you land?
End up at 3XY. Barry Chapman was at SM. Barry made me an offer and was just are you interested in this? And I thought, Sydney's hometown. I thought it was too early to go to Sydney. So I declined that. And Mike Webb had just left NX to go down and set up 2WS with Keith Graham. So, and Webby said, "Oh, you might be interested in coming down here." I said, "Oh, this brand new thing, I'm not sure about that." So I said no. And then Smithy had called once he got to Melbourne and said, "You know, would you be interested in coming to Melbourne?" I thought, I'd never thought of Melbourne, but I knew Graham. And I thought, spoke to my wife at the time and said, what do you think? So off we went. We picked up on Melbourne, and it was I'm so happy I did that. It was an experience. Otherwise, you know, I can't see myself living in Victoria rather than having been there. And the time in Melbourne was outstanding. It was only a couple of years, but it was very formative for people I met and the experiences and what we did. So it was good.
No doubt an exciting and at times interesting appointment, which almost had you working with the human headline Darren Hinch in the mornings. Tell us about that potential combination, and in retrospect, was Hinch the best fit for 3XY at the time?
Well, it was. I was doing afternoons, so Smithy put me straight into afternoons, like a noon to three thing. And Hinchy and Keith Williams were doing, it was Hinch and Williams, or Williams and Hinch, I forget which way it goes. And then Keith's a good friend. He sells me product when we build a radio station, so he should be a good friend. Anyway, so he bailed, and he said it's just working with Hinch was too hard because Darren got the taste of it. And I like them both. I love Darren and I love Keith. But Keith said, this is just too much, so he pulled out. Smithy came and said, listen, he said, I can't put Hinchy in by himself because it's just, you know, he's just so hungry for all of it, which is, you know, which is good. And he said, do you want to work with Darren? I said, I'm happy to give it a go. No worry about that. So Graham said, walk past my office door at such and such a time. I walked past the office door, and Graham is just telling Darren. Darren's got his back to the door, and Graham's telling Darren. He said, "I've got you another partner." And Darren said, "Who?" And he said, "Him." And Hinchy and I got along famously. And he said, "You?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Come and sit down. We're having a chat." And I said, "Darren, if you go off topic and you don't bring me with you, and I don't understand what's going on," I said, "I'm just going to cut your microphone off." Anyway, Hinchy and I never got on air together. So, because that was it, he said he wanted to go away and have a think, and then he pulled the pin, and probably rightfully so, because he went to AW, and he's look at the career. But you gotta love Darren. I mean, I've dubbed him many times since, and I'm sorry that he's not going to be your Lord Mayor, but he would have been a cracker of a headline. But he's a bloke who kind of made himself his own food critic when he was running the radio, when he was running the newspaper. So you gotta admire him. He's a good bloke. But we didn't work together, which is probably unfortunate, or probably that's why we're still friends.
Gonna make you mourning, whole world's talking, let the whole wide world talk to you. Melbourne, come out to play, they're gonna help you through your day. Hans and Barry, 3XY.
Now, as you mentioned, Darren left and went to 3AW, and you were partnered up with Barry Bissell to do mornings. So what was the format brief given to you guys?
Yeah, well, that's where working with Graham Smith was always exciting. He was prepared to have a punt. And he said, okay, he just wanted something different in there, because he could have just put one jock in there and made it a music shift or whatever. So the instruction was, let's go do a magazine program, but for a particular demographic. And the demographic was a 3XY demo. We weren't to chase anything else. A lot of music in there, a lot of interviews. So we got all the big stars at any time in town, and certainly all the locals and things like that. And we had, Sue Gadinski as our producer. So before she married Mike, and she, what a cracker, she's a firecracker, and kept Bissell and I in line with no mucking about. But we did some good lunches. And she was instrumental in I guess it's like driving a carriage, and you got two horses out there, you can keep it in line, and then and she managed to do it. She's a really good bird. I have very, very fond memories of that whole experience with Biss, and I had listened to his podcast on here as well, and he's got much sharper memories of different events and things like that. But I do agree with them on a couple of things about some of the interviews we did, because we had everybody in there. Spike Milligan was like ludicrous. It was just, and unfortunately I don't think he kept a copy of it either, because everything was reel to reel tape. And so we never sort of grabbed a quick air check here or there. So, and then who else? There were many, many, many stars, come in the door and then out, and politicians, left, right, and centre, and whatever. So, but we had to keep a kind of a light aspect on it, and keep it kind of fun. So it was good.
Now, Gibson and Moore had been very successful on 2SM in the same time slot. Was there an attempt to try to emulate them?
We never listened to them, because remembering the era, it wasn't that easy to pull an air check from interstate or anything like that. And we knew they were operating, and if you wanted one, somebody might send you a cassette, and you go, right, I'll have a listen to the cassette. I honestly don't recall having listened to them very closely at all. What was inspiring us? I don't know. We're just doing our own thing. Two blokes experimenting, and some of it was experimental, no question about that. And then clearly, we had not free reign. We still had to get everything done. And keep it within time limits. And we did a lot of pre-recording and editing and then feeding it back. So I was on the panel side, Biss was on the other side hanging phones and getting things going, and Sue would come in and chat up about what we needed to do next. And some of the interviews at a drop of the hat, and say, well, pick that up. And then we had a guy called Jeff Wall who was doing some research for us as well. And he was really good. He'd look for quirky things, saying, how do they get the stickers on oranges? When they first started putting stickers on apples, and you get Batlow number 2740 or something. So how do they get those on there? So it was just really odd stuff that we did, and it was all kind of fun. There was a couple of decent, interesting promotions that we did down there, and I'll never forget. I met one of my very, very good mates, Greg Hendricks, who was sports guy at 2SM. And when the Melbourne Cup was on, and we had we had the double-decker bus out there at the Melbourne Cup, and then everybody had to get back out of the grounds and go home. And Hendo hitched a ride with us in the 3XY vehicles, and I'm driving one of those. And we're stuck in a traffic jam. People jumping out of their cars, coming back to the 3XY car, bashing on there, saying, 3XY rocks me. 3XY rocks Melbourne. And then Hendo said to me, he said, how long has this been going on? I said, mate, this is Melbourne. This is what's happening. And he was super impressed, and he was out of the SM mold and never seen anything like that. And that was 3XY in Melbourne. It was something special.
It was indeed. In fact, it was the hottest radio ticket in town with the strongest on-air lineup and a month like no other.
January, February, March. And so, in the honour of rock and roll, it has been proclaimed that the 10th month shall be forever known as Rocktober. Roll over, 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 Rocktober. On 3XY. Love the station. Hate the jingle.
So, Hans, what can you tell us about the history of Rocktober?
Yeah, it's been pretty well documented, I think, Paul, but certainly, you know, chatting with my brother at the time, not at the time of Rocktober, but it was his invention, and he has said before that he always enjoyed playing with words. You know, to day he died, you know, he was always writing different pieces and things and letters to editors, and I'd go into his office when we shared, you know, offices in the Hot Tomato. I'd go into his office and say, what are you doing, by the way? And I'll get upset because I'm working flat out. I don't think he's working as hard as I am. I go, what are you doing? He said, I'm writing. I go, okay. So, but he was writing promos and different things, and he was word playing with Rocktober. And I think at some point he'd said it was interesting how some of the other countries had been putting words together and creating new words, and that's where that happened. And he, I just say, shame we didn't, oh, shame, not we, shame you, or somebody didn't, you know, tie it down and hold the rights to it. And he said, yeah, he said, should have copyrighted it, but hindsight didn't matter. So, and I've got, how many times you get pinched Ocktober and whatever Tober and, you know, Hooly Dooly Vember, I don't know. It's just people grabbed the idea and ran with it. So that was it. But it was a good month, though. Rocktober was great.
A favourite Rocktober memory or promotion?
I don't really have one from Rocktober. That's one of the things that's interesting over a period of time. You think, oh, well, there are lots of them. I have other memories of music specials. I remember in Melbourne, because I got there late 78 or early, late 78, 79, I think. So it must have been 78, because my daughter was born in 79 in Melbourne. And then Smithy had said, we're going to do a special called Living in the 70s. So, so he went to all the jocks and said, okay, everybody's got a different year. So you got to make a 1 hour special for that year, 1970 gets some. I think I got 1974 or something like that. So you had 1 year, build a 1 hour special, and we had Nigel Haynes in production doing another genius engineer, and so Nigel was putting all this together, and then at the end of the thing, we had this whole Living in the 70s special, and off it went. And then Smithy went out and got a guy called Ian McCausland, who was Mushroom Records head of graphic design, and he made a poster of Living in the 70s, and I've still got a copy of it here somewhere framed. And I remember that special more than I remember Rocktober particularly, because, you know, Rocktober can be any genre, but the 70s thing was focused on what it was about.
The next move was a 12-year stint at 2WS, which of course converted to the FM band in 1993. Now, mornings on 2WS must have been an interesting time with the controversial Stan Zamanek as your producer.
I did have Stan. The WS year is actually 20. I'd spent two stints at WS. So I'd gone up and done daytime and mornings with Stan, and then I took a sabbatical and tried to put my marriage back together. I came to Queensland, then I went back to WS and did Breakfast. But Stan was in the morning, so it's a Mike Webb special. So Webby finally got me. He pitched me when I was at 3XY. I said, come on, it's time to come back up. And so we finally got to the dollars, and it was only the dollars that made me move. I was pretty happy in Melbourne, but I was also kind of happy to get back to hometown. So I get up there, and then so I've lobbed, and I was there for a couple of months, and then maybe, and then Webby says, we need a producer. He said, I've got this bloke for you. So Stan Zemanek. And I go and see Stan, and he said, let's go and have a couple of beers and see whether we're compatible. And we go to the Golden Sheaf Hotel in Double Bay. And we're sitting there drinking schooners, and I have to leave my car because I've had so many schooners. I've got to get a taxi back to the north side where I stay. I go looking for Stan. I've lost him. And I think, well, I've got to say goodbye to this bloke. He's somewhere here. I can't find him. And I phone his wife, Marcella, who was still friends. And I said, Marcella, I said, I've lost your husband here. She said, no, he's here in bed. So Stan had just had enough. He walked out of the pub, went home, and went to bed. And so we decided that we were compatible because I understood that part. And then it was just some interesting times. He was keener to make the show a bit more like a John Laws show than it should have been. Keith Graham at the time was still alive and said, no, this ain't working. So he pulled the pin on Stan and said, time for you to go. So then I was running one out. But it was an interesting time, and Stan and I remained good friends till he passed. And I saw him not long before that happened.
Now, of course, Breakfast was where you spent most of your time, with Kayleigh Harris as your co-host. So was it instant radio chemistry with Kayleigh, or was it a partnership that evolved?
It evolved, and I'm glad you raised it, because she is unsung heroes of many in radio, and she's one of them. And Kayleigh and I, relationship, it evolved. She was doing traffic, and she used to sit outside the studio and then come in, and I used to say, get her in more. We'll get somebody else to sit out there, because she's she adds so much light and shade and that female perspective to what we were doing. So it kind of grew from that, and then we moved her into the studio, then we hired Rebecca Orr, who's now Rebecca Chapman, to sit outside, and she's another little live wire. But Kayleigh's contribution cannot be overestimated. It was a good chemistry. I promise, and it's been 20 years since, more than 22 years since I did that, I still have people comment on it who I bump into, and most of them say, my mum and dad used to listen to you. I hate that part. But the Hans and Kayleigh brand held through and still shines every now and again, and I go, I'm very proud of that, and so is Kayleigh, and we're in touch all the time. So, and you know, she pops up and sees us up here on the Gold Coast, when she can, and then we get Rebecca up as well. We get that sort of high old time. I'm just going to bring in a lot of Pinot Grigio.
So were you both morning people?
Yeah, we were, and it was, once you got into the rhythm, it wasn't hard. But you had to get into the rhythm. People, and everybody who's done Breakfast will tell you that it's a social killer. But it's very rewarding. And so you slide into that studio, switch the mic on, get everything going, and you know you're kind of home. And when I go on holidays and you come back to work, I think there's nothing more comfortable than the studio chair. I used to get a kick out of it. I really did. I haven't been on air for, as I said, 22 years, 23 years. I don't miss it, but I have great fond recollections of it in all the studios, with Bissell in Melbourne, with in Brisbane, everywhere. I can visualise each studio today and go, oh yeah, that was kind of fun. That gear was rubbish, and this was okay, and then. But I always got along with the techs. I thought that was always very important. So they'll help you fix gear in a hurry.
Now, Hans, back in the day, listeners used to request a song by phone, but for some, they just found it easier to walk through the back door of the station.
Yeah, it was one of the scariest things because we realised that we weren't that secure. We're at WS, we're on the air, and he was drunk, had come in. There was a back door where the smokers used to go outside to have a ciggy, and somebody had left the door unlocked, and it's 6 o'clock in the morning or 6:15. And Kaylee's eyes just lit up. So there's some strange guy through the studio window. He was just, I want a song. And we didn't know whether it was drugs or whatever it was. And I said to the girls, you go that way and get newsroom to call the police. And then we talked him out to down the back, said, put a couple of long songs on, and the newsroom was still there, and they gave me a hand, and they just said, look, we just didn't manhandle, didn't touch him, just said, come on, mate, Danny, what do you want? He said, I want to hear this song, la la la, and nobody's answering the phones. And I thought, well, somebody should answer the phone. It would have made it a lot easier. But so the police finally turned up and hustled him off, and from there on we locked the door. So, but it was just, it was a very uncomfortable feeling.
Intruders aside, so many years at the one station, you must have some great memories.
Yeah, well, that was the station's logo, greatest memories, latest hits, and I did a lot of time there. When we converted to FM, that was a really big campaign. Now, Graham Mott was general manager in those days, and he had been PD and a really good analytical PD and a very, very sharp operator as GM as well. Good people manager, I thought. But he conceptualised that what we've got to do is show people how to switch from WS on 1224 to 1.7 and then show people. So we would actually, if you're having trouble tuning it in your car, we'd do roadside stops, like a police breathalyzer, and say, just pull up here and we'll retune it for you. Because we're simulcasting at the time, so we're on AM and FM, and we just want to get them across onto the FM band as much as we could and not miss the opportunity. So that was a really big campaign, and it went off pretty well. We got the air check for that. So we survived, and it's still there.
102.9 Hot Tomato.
So what does one do after spending 30 successful years in the industry? The answer to the tour of siblings was quite simple. Create your own brand new radio station. So what was the inspiration behind the formation of Hot Tomato?
We got chatting, my sister and my brother and myself. And at the time, I'm a country music fan. And I thought, and the two biggest country music markets in Australia were Tamworth and Sydney's West, believe it or not. So, and I always had this idea of picking up a little radio station license, like a community license, because nobody was doing country music in Sydney at the time. 2SM had a crack at doing the Kicks thing or whatever it was. But I thought, well, we go and buy a pub, a big pub, and we build a studio into it. We put a stage, like an auditorium, and we have live music, and we can record it, play it live, get people to come in, sell a lot of merchandise, do that. So we get the hotel revenue, bit of radio revenue, get a bit of stuff going and play the games. So we started hunting down the hotels. What happened was the government then decided to allow poker machines into hotels. The price of the hotels went past the price of radio stations. So we had this idea, but the particular pub we wanted that was supposed to be, 5 or 6 million turned out to be $24 million. And that makes sense. The business plan didn't stack up. So we parked that, and then coincidentally, the government put the license on the Gold Coast up for auction, and we had a good think about it. Said, look, would we like to play this game instead? And the answer was, yeah, come on, let's give it a go. So we did, and we clearly won the license, and then had a year to get it together and get it on air, which was pretty good achievement. And I must say, it's probably my favourite legacy from my radio career. We sold the business a few years back, 2018, but it's still there. It's still number one. It's beaten the two big gorillas in town, it's still far and away now. But however, it's now owned by ARN, so it's gone the full circle. So the little family operated radio station Killing the Giants is now, you know, in the home of the Giants. But it was some great people there who made that happen. People like Graham Miles, our general manager, who lives ten houses away from me now, and we still catch up. I'll be having beers with Milesy this afternoon. But just really, really good operators and people who threw their lot in and made it happen. It's a really good experience. So it is. It's full circle. I never thought, you know, hey, we're going to own a radio station one day and start one from scratch. Mind you, we built a good one because we'd seen some shitty ones.
I'm sure you have. Now, Hot Tomato isn't the most conventional radio station name. How'd you land on that one?
We had to find a name of a holding company to bid for the license. And so my sister suggested, because her married name at the time was Mann, M-A-N-N. So she said, look, Torv, T-O, Mann, M-A, Torv, T-O. So my brother, so Tomato. She said, let's call it Tomato Proprietary Limited. And my brother, as we said, working with words, said there's not enough buzz in that, so let's call it Hot Tomato. So it was supposed to only be a holding company, Hot Tomato Broadcasting Company Proprietary Limited. So we put that in. When we won the license, there was not a sub-editor in the country who couldn't avoid a play on the Hot Tomato concept. So we had a struggle about what we're going to call the radio station. Call it Sand. How can Hot Tomato bring you Sand FM or this or that or whatever? And then we bit the bullet and said, well, okay, let's just, what if we did call it Hot Tomato? And so many people said, are you crazy? Like, and I called it Q102 or something. I said, well, what's the buzz in that? So we stuck with Hot Tomato. And here it's still Hot Tomato today, but I wonder for how long. But anyway, that's its history is there. And the Gold Coast is the only town in the world with a Hot Tomato radio station.
As you said, sold the station in 2018. Given the history and where you'd come from, how hard was it to do that?
Yeah, it was difficult, but we had some other parts of our business plan, and we're still selling down some stuff that we own together in partnership. So it was part of that. I figured some headwinds for radio as well. So we had a look at it. Said you either grow. You move on. So we decided to move on. There's a lot of with digital broadcasting and things like there's a lot of ask for capital expenditure, and we said, you know what, do we have the appetite for that? I said, I could have brought my sister out. Eventually, we brought my brother out. He wanted to go and do other things, so we purchased him, and my sister and I owned it 50-50. And then I could have bought her out. And I thought, oh, do I want that debt? I said, nah. So we achieved what we wanted to achieve, and it was just great fun. And I just getting too tired for doing all that sort of thing. So I'm pretty happily retired at the moment.
Okay, a couple of quick questions. You mentioned it earlier on, but how long did it take for you to realise that talking behind a microphone was a heck of a lot easier than lugging wheelbarrows full of bricks?
Not long at all. But I've got a bunch of mates, and we're still good friends. And I met these guys. One of them I went to high school with in Sydney, and we're all still good friends. We're all still here, and we shared a house together before I got into the radio game at all. And then they said, oh, you come back to Sydney, so we'll share a house again together. So they got me a gig on a building site in town. And I had to join the Builders Labourers Federation. Now, there's an experience. But we had the best fun, just as a bunch of mates in a big house share who were all friends. Nobody was a stranger. And I don't regret it in one minute. I couldn't keep doing the work because I'm just physically not up for it. And neither did they. They all sort of moved on slightly, and they were building engineers and carpenters and things like that. But it was interesting, very interesting period. And you know what? It ties you into what people who work physically hard. It gives you an appreciation of how they go. And I think that's part of life's experience to say, you know, I remember that. I remember being part of the union, and I remember, you know, coming home sore and dirty, and how good a beer tasted. You know, I can't tell any of the stories about how many beers we'd have at lunchtime and then go back on the site. That was like, anyway, wouldn't happen today, I don't think.
Hey, Hans, can you tell me what a litre of petrol is worth in Carrara at the moment?
In Carrara? Because I don't actually, it's about $2.20. The only reason I know that is because I buy it my little closer. We do own a service station, and this is part of the investment. So it's a 7-Eleven servo with I've got a sushi. There's a sushi restaurant. There's a little Italian takeaway. There's a Vietnamese bakery. They make very good banh mi. So if you want some of those, it's not bad. But it's a good passive investment. I have somebody manage that for us, and it's somewhere to park some radio station money.
Hans, I've got 12 questions in front of me that we ask all our guests. The first one being, where were you when you heard that John Lennon had died?
I've had a good think about that, and I don't actually recall, because I know it was December, and you know what? Because I remember I listened to Bissell's podcast, and he remembers exactly where he was. He said Albert Park, such and such. And I go, I don't even know where I was. So sorry for that, but I couldn't tell you. I'm unsure.
The last concert ticket you paid for?
I had to think about that, and would have been AC/DC in Brisbane. And we, a group of us hired from the Gold Coast, hired a 45-seater bus, loaded it up with Eskies, and off we went for the, I think it was the Runaway Train concert tour. And we all just chipped in our thing, and we had an area, and I think we had a box. So we went up there. Coming home was a bit different from going up, I know that. We had to get the bus to stop a few times, but it was AC/DC.
Hans, is there a concert act that you regret never seeing?
As I said, I'm a country music fan. As a young girl who started in country music, and her career got bigger and bigger, and I thought, I wonder whether I could have gone to see that, and be Taylor Swift, funnily enough. It's what an artist, what an act. So. And that's the rest of it. I could go back in history and things like that and say, oh, but I thought, you know, that was pretty intriguing when she deceived that what this kid's done.
Was there a word you had most trouble pronouncing on air?
Never had a real strike on it that I recall, but in the Woolloombar, there's a lot of Aboriginal places around. There's a little town between the Woolloombar and the Gold Coast of Coolangatta, and it's called Tumbulgum, but it's spelled Tumblegum. So, and everybody comes down, they'd beat you over the head if you got that wrong. The first time you hit it, you look at it and go, it's Tumblegum. And you can tell the newbies.
Hans, was there ever an incident on air that had you thinking you might get those Don't Come Monday orders?
No, there's no particular one jumps out. No, I don't. And that's not to say we didn't do stuff that, you know, we probably shouldn't have done, but nothing was, you know, you can't do that. You can't say that. I remember once in Melbourne, though, I did Bissell and I were on the air, and I dropped a line about at the checkout of a supermarket. And I said, man, the lines at the checkout were so long. I said, the staff came around and changed the prices of everything in the trolley three times. And the problem was I mentioned Tooronga Village. And I didn't mention the name of the supermarket. Smithy came in and said, what the F did you say about Woolies? And I said, nothing about Woolies. And he said, well, he said, they're pulling $60,000, $70,000 with advertising because you've said something about their prices going up all the time. And I said, nothing. It turns out that the Tooronga Village is a well-known Woolies major headquarters or something like that. So that was the only one that gave me a bit of a fright. And I never forgot the story. But I thought the line was pretty good.
Skyhooks or Sherbet?
We're in Melbourne when Skyhooks bounced out. And how can you not love a band who sing, you know, you only like me because I'm good in bed? or pop out something like horror movie right there on my TV. Definitely Skyhooks.
The Rolling Stones or the Beatles?
I know a lot of people said, oh, two great bands, either or. I'm a bit partial on this. The first song we played on Hot Tomato when we launched was Sympathy for the Devil. And then I was thinking last night about when you're going to ask me this question. And then I realised I'm wearing a Rolling Stones T-shirt as my pyjamas. So it's pretty I've got to go Rolling Stones.
Hans, what's your most treasured piece of memorabilia from your early radio days?
Funnily, I've got a couple, if I don't mind. One was a 3XY Melbourne Smithy organised some really, really well-made knitted sweaters with the denim logo on them, through the zipper logo, and with really good quality. You know, not just iron-on transfer and everything. These were knitted into the jumpers and made in the right size. And that was a really good. I kept it for ages. My daughter is still wearing it to these, and she's 27, but she's, so if she said, "Dad, I'm going to wear this," I said, "Right, it's yours, because it doesn't fit me anymore." I know that. And the other one was the poster from Living in the 70s. I still have that. It's a special piece of art for my thinking.
Can you recall the biggest news story that broke while you were on air?
There are probably bigger ones, but the one that's most memorable that I remember having a fair bit of impact was when Shirley Strawn's helicopter went down, and because he was in wherever it was in the Hunter Valley or something like that, so it had crashed, and it was early in that we got on air, and the story came through, and the response from the audience was raw, and it was palpable. With people calling. So the music playlist went out the window that morning, and we just played Skyhooks, and people call up and talked about what they thought about it, stuff like that. So I think because it was local and it was somebody that they related to. Remember, he was a TV star as well and all that. So that changed one whole breakfast show like boom. And then for the following week, and they did specials on it and stuff like that as well.
Yes, it just shows the versatility of radio, being able to, one, change your format, and two, get instant feedback straight away from the listeners.
Yep, and no question about that. And that was, I think, Moddy was PD or GM, whoever it was, and we just said, there was no question. I don't have to make any phone calls to say, I'm going to do this. We just did it, and it was fine. But every now and again, you might get a call on the hotline to say, hey, don't forget about you. You got this opportunity, you got that opportunity. Don't be afraid to do that, or play the songs, or good on you. There was great support for doing something like that.
Hans, the moment someone walked into your studio and you were suddenly starstruck.
I think it's probably John Travolta. Not so much starstruck, but just really impressive. He has a presence. And this is when Barry and I are doing the show, and Travolta sat on that side of the desk beside Barry, and the three of us having a chat. But he was just there, so calm and so easy to talk to, and he's a massive Hollywood star. And he's going, righto. And we had Olivia in, as well, different times, not together. But he, at the end of the interview, I remember him going, hey, this was really interesting, having the three-way chat on the way around. And I thought he was really out there. There was the one. I've got a photo. I've got a little poster board in my garage with different shots on it, which is still stuck. And he's one of them there. I forget who. I have to go and have a look and see who else is on it.
Can you tell me the best words of advice from a program manager?
I know everybody has said the same thing, is saying be yourself. And I think it's pretty true, because what happens is everybody's trying to emulate whoever they want, or whoever were their heroes, as it goes. I remember reading an interview with Mike Carlton in Sydney, and I'm sorry Mike's not on the air anymore, because I thought he was a great broadcaster and an even funnier journalist. But Carlton said once, so when he got on the air, he said for the first 6 months he thought he was John Laws. so he tried to do a show like Lawsy, and then realise he's better off just being Carlton, and he did some good stuff. I really like that. But the be yourself. And then Graham Smith once said to me, stop mumbling.
Okay, I'll do my best with this one then. Two albums that you would consider to be the soundtrack of your teenage years.
Yeah, I'm not sort of mainstream, but I've always been a folky and a bit of a country fan. So I've been a lifelong Gordon Lightfoot fan. His album, If You Could Read My Mind, is just something jumps out of nowhere. And because that particular song, mind you, that album used to be called Sit Down, Young Stranger, until If You Could Read My Mind became the bigger hit and they changed the name of it. So I really love that. And I went and saw him in the early 70s. I got some tickets, 2SM gave me some tickets. And he was so stoned on stage, he forgot the words to his own songs. The bastard. Anyway, and the other one, I don't know, and the same that year, like Abbey Road, the Beatles, and things like that. And we're listening to the Rolling Stones, you know, Sweet Virginia, and things like that. And the other album in those days, because at university, everybody had a guitar, and we'd sit around singing Cat Stevens songs, getting wind up and stoned probably. But the Tea for the Tillerman album still resonates.
Well, Hans, that's been a very busy hour. Thank you so much for your time, your reminiscing, your significant contribution to radio in Australia, for being part of Pilots of the Airwaves, and also to those kind words you said about the podcast.
Well, I'll keep listening and I'll send you notes.
I look forward to that. Thanks again.
Thanks, mate. Appreciate it.
Hans Torv on Pilots of the Airwaves.